Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, zip up your leather pants, slap on the clown paint, and don't forget to eat something light as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
This is Monsteropolis, a show about legends, monsters, and anomalies. There, I got it in. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm one of your hosts. I'm joined, as always, by my dear friend, Andy.
Greetings.
You're supposed to say your name.
Oh, Andy Matzke. You said my first name.
I said your first name. You got to tell people who you are.
When I say Andy, you say Matzke.
You didn't say
anything. By the way, we've been recording at this point for well over 2 hours, so we may fly off the rails very soon. I'm joined as well by Andy's father,
Mark Matzke.
And today, whenever you're listening to this particular episode of Monsteropolis, we are talking about the Dover Demon, one of our favorite cryptids here on Monsteropolis. We used to talk about this one all the time. Like our last episode, the Jersey Devil, this is a monster we frequently get asked if we are going to cover in one of our small town monsters films. I don't think we will. I don't think we're going to get there. Mark, why don't you walk us through the story in as much detail, taking as much time as you need to really flesh this out for our listeners.
All right. The basic outline will just be that. But no, that's good. The thing that is really, really key about understanding the Dover Demon story is how limited it is. It happened over about a 25-hour period. That's all the sightings of the Dover Demon that have ever been. So this is all taking place in April of 1977. And I'll just stop to make my first aside, which is that at first I thought, hearing 77, I wondered if Star Wars had any influence on this at all. And it couldn't have, because Star Wars wasn't out in April of 77. So anyway, Dover, Massachusetts is the place. That's 15 miles southwest of Boston. And when we were talking about the Bridgewater Triangle, I remember you had asked, is that anywhere close to Dover? And it's, you know, a straight air miles. You're talking about 25 to 30 miles from Dover into the northern part of the Bridgewater Triangle.
So it was a denizen of the Bridgewater Triangle that had accidentally wandered out of its home turf.
That's it. That's the episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. We solved it.
He wanted to go to Cheers and got lost.
It's a puck wudgie.
It's just a puck.
It's a puck wudgie with mange.
With no clothes on.
That's it.
Naked puck wudgie.
With mange.
So we're on Twitter. Okay. So the thing that's really cool about this whole case is how highly detailed it is in terms of research, because not only was Lauren Coleman directly involved in the very first interviewing of the principal witnesses, but a man named Walter Webb also wrote a detailed report about it because he was involved as well. And Walter Webb was the assistant director of the Hayden Planetarium for the Boston Science Museum. So credentialed and locked into the sort of the scientific end of things. Interestingly enough, he also was the first person to interview and look into the details of the Barney and Betty Hill UFO abduction case. So, pretty cool. What? Pretty cool guy to have on your team.
That's right. That probably isn't very far from there either, right?
No. And the thing that Webb was at first a little bit hesitant, I guess, to get involved with this case. But one of the things that ended up being compelling to him is he only lived about 4 miles away from where the sightings allegedly took place. So it was convenient, at the very least, for him to be involved.
I have a question before we go on any further.
Sure.
What does the area look like? You said you looked at it on Google Earth. Is it like forested or suburban?
It's intermittently forested. If you would imagine around here, let's say a higher end suburb where there's lots of green space and there's an occasional patch of forest, that pretty much says it. There's lots of horses, which factors into potential explanations later on. But it's very well to do, very natural in some cases. Where there are homes, they're generally set off of the road quite far. So it's a well-to-do area. You know, in fact, somewhere I saw this, that Dover was referred to as one of the most affluent cities or towns in Massachusetts, period. So it's sort of a exurb or a far suburb of Boston. Oh, yeah, here it is. Wealthiest town in Massachusetts. They just go ahead and say it. A population of around 5,000, heavily wooded. So the Dover Demon, the report is Lauren Coleman makes the first contact with people 1 week after the sightings. And it's very strange the way that he's notified about these cases. He just happened to be at the Dover Country Store, just minding his own business, shopping, evidently. And one of the employees there, named Melody Fryer, told him about William Bartlett's sighting. So this was April 28th. This Bartlett sighting happened on the 21st. So it was exactly a week later. 2 days later, Lauren Coleman had been given two of Bartlett's sketches that he immediately made after the sighting. And on May 1st, Lauren Coleman interviewed William Bartlett for the first time. And then May 3rd, Lauren Coleman interviewed two other witnesses, John Baxter and Abby Brabham. And about 2 days later, Will Tainter was questioned. Will was with Abby during her sighting. So what these people reported seeing, just for someone who's wondering, well, what did the Dover Demon look like in the first place? It was described as gnome-like, with a large head, sort of watermelon-shaped, if you will, with glowing eyes and spindly limbs. So let's get into the story as Webb gets involved.
You know what? Before we go any further, sure. Andy, did you watch any Lost Tapes episodes
I watched a Lost Tapes episode about this.
Did you really?
Yeah. my research consists of
watching
Lost
Tapes. I feel like
Andy
needs to be on the show every week to tell us about the Lost Tapes episode he watched relating to the topic.
This Lost Tapes episode was very creative. Mm-hmm. It was about a group of people, making a fake Dover Demon video, like hoaxing a video, mm-hmm. In like celebration of the anniversary of of the thing they like to drum up, you know, talk about it. Yeah. So in the video, they all go out in the woods, and of course they get attacked, and they're all like, "What's going on?" And they get separated, and it turns out the Dover Demon made a trap, and
he made a trap.
He trapped everybody. Like, it was like a hole.
What's he do?
He just comes into the hole afterwards, and he kills them. It's a very uneventful episode, yet creative. But for being a fake video, it's very bad at representing making a fake video. It's very go watch it. It's entertaining.
It's the Dover Demon as bloodthirsty predator.
You watched it too?
Yeah.
Okay. I guess I'm missing out. Okay.
And Lauren is the
Lauren Coleman's
is the dependable talking head who sort of leavens everything with
it ends with an ambiguous shot of like one of the friends like holding the camera, like showing themselves, and it like flashing the night vision and the Dover demon being behind him. It's never explained.
Okay. All right, sorry, Mark. Right. Please take us back to reality.
Okay. So, quick timeline. May 1st, Lauren Coleman gave one of the sketches that was made by Bartlett to the Dover Police Department. On May 4th, Lauren Coleman contacted The Real Paper in Cambridge. That's its actual name. The paper interviewed Lauren Coleman, Bartlett, Baxter, and the chief of police for Dover on May 7th. On May 12th, the Framingham radio called the police department looking for stories. They learned about the Dover demon story and aired it the next day. On May 14th, Associated Press and another newspaper called Lauren Coleman for information. On the 15th, papers started to run the story. By the next day, the 16th, the Boston Globe, Boston Herald, and other New England-based papers had picked it up, and it just went wide. So Walter Webb heard about it on around the 14th of May. He was pretty sure it was a hoax. I mean, he didn't give it much thought, but people kept bringing it up to him because they knew that he was really interested in unexplained things. And he thought, it's 4 miles from my home. It don't have much to lose. So he visited the Dover Police Department. From them, he got Lauren Coleman's contact information and got in contact with Coleman. They decided to team up on the investigation. And they included two other men, one named Joseph Nyman with MUFON and Ed Fogg of the Northeast UFO, or the New England UFO Study Group. So from then, that point on, it was the four of them interviewing the principal witnesses, where before, just within about a week of in the April sightings time, Lauren had interviewed them separately by himself. So on May 21st, the team talked to John Baxter, Abby, and Will. Lauren Coleman led the team then, same day, to the three sites where the creature was allegedly sighted. They took photos and measurements, and they finally then got an interview with Bartlett, who had been hospitalized with mono. That was June 11th that they got to talk to him.
The kissing disease.
Yeah. So, Bartlett's sighting.
I was about to make a joke about kissing the Dover demon. Just imagine it.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I did visualize it, which is why I moved on so quickly. The Bartlett sighting was April 21st. By the way, he's 17 years old at the time of the sighting. He was driving with two friends. It was about 10:30 p.m. He had taken a few puffs of a doob about an hour prior to the sighting.
Classic doob situation.
Yep. Taken a few pulls, which he had always, from the very beginning, admitted to.
Mm-hmm.
But he said he was clear-minded at the time of the sighting.
It's a teenager in the 70s.
I hope so, seeing as how he was driving a car with two friends.
I'm sure, but he's fine.
Yeah. Fine. What's the worst that could happen?
Yeah.
So he's driving north approximately 45 miles an hour on Farm Street, spotted something creeping along a low wall of loose stones on the left side of the road, which if you're a complete nerd like me, you can actually find on Google Earth.
Yeah, you texted cool. You texted me about this, actually.
Yeah, I know. So, which means it would have been on the driver's side of the car. The figure appeared to place its hands and feet carefully on the stones, like it was unsure what to do, like how to get over the wall. And it slowly turned its head to look at the car and stared into the high beams of the lights. Bartlett said its head was shaped like a watermelon, and it made that about the same size as the creature's trunk or body. It had large, round, glassy, lidless eyes shining like two orange marbles. Bartlett's exact quote is, "It looked like a baby's body with long arms and legs." It had hairless skin. It appeared to be smudged by dirt. And the skin had a rough texture like wet sandpaper. And the color was, Bartlett was insistent, it was a peach color like Fred Flintstone in the Sunday comics. And we're talking about something that was evidently 3.5 to 4 feet tall, and no tail was observed. The sighting lasted 5 or 6 seconds max. The team estimated that the vehicle passed within 20 feet of the creature. None of the other two people in the vehicle saw it, but Bartlett was visibly shaken, very troubled by what he had seen, to the degree that his friends prevailed on him to turn around after driving about a mile, go back and try to see the thing again, but they didn't. There was nothing there. And the friends of Bartlett that were interviewed numerous times always said that he seemed genuinely frightened about whatever it is that he saw. He was having fun, having a good time, and everything completely changed based on what he saw. And immediately when Bartlett got home, he drew a figure of what he saw. That's probably the most, along with Baxter, I mean, their sketches match incredibly well. And it's what we associate with the figure of the Dover Demon today is Bartlett's sketch.
Yeah, the fact that there are drawings, actually there were drawings done by all three of the witnesses, right? Like all three of the...
Okay. By Bartlett and Baxter.
For some reason, I thought there was one done by the third. But anyway, they look remarkably similar. And everything that I was looking at was like they were totally unconnected, but you're telling me they actually did know each other.
Yes. Bartlett and Baxter were friends at school. Okay. Yeah. For the record, Bartlett's parents continued to insist always that he was an honest and open son. And they had no reason to doubt that of what he saw. He wasn't given to making up stories. So that's the first sighting. The second sighting is John Baxter's, and that happened about 2 hours after Bartlett's, about a mile northeast of the Bartlett site. Baxter left his girlfriend's house and started walking home. He's walking north on Miller's Hill Road. After a half hour of walking, he saw a silhouette of someone approaching him about 100 feet away. As the figure got closer, he realized it was a very small someone approaching him. He thought it was a kid who lived in the neighborhood and who he knew, and he called out his name and received no reply, so they just continued to walk towards each other. When they were about 25 feet apart, the figure stopped, and so Baxter did too, and he called out, "Who's that?" There's no reply, and right at that moment then, the thing, whatever it was, scurried rapidly down into a shallow wooded gully and back up the opposite bank. Baxter said he could hear its footfalls as it ran. So they were about 30 feet apart, and Baxter said that the creature's feet sort of molded around the rocks that it was standing on, and that's reflected in the drawing that he made. Long fingers of both hands gripping a tree for support. And the team measured the tree later as 8 inches in diameter. Baxter estimates that they stared each other down for a couple minutes. And then Baxter said, walked backwards up the slope. He said his heart was pounding. And he walked very fast down to the intersection with Farm Street. Hitched a ride home. Got home about 1 a.m. And immediately drew a sketch of what he saw. John's mother said he never made up any stories. John's father said, yeah, he's not given to making up false stories, but he is a big sci-fi fan. And that continued to come up in Webb's report and Lauren's comments as well, is that you always have to keep in mind that John Baxter was well-versed in science fiction, and there was a resurgence in the popularity of Lord of the Rings, and there's... comparisons made to Gollum throughout their reports as well, just making sure that that was out there as a fact. The owner of the property on which...
Yeah, there were different red flags raised by the Dover Demon when he was first spotted, says, "We wants it." My precious.
Yeah, he made this weird choking sound. So the owner of the property, a woman named Alice Stewart, was not aware of the sighting, but had heard stories in the community about the Dover Demon, which is, you know, this is, of course, is after the fact, when she was interviewed, not at the time. Now, according to them, Bartlett was unaware of Baxter's incident until 5 days later, which would have been April 26th. And John showed Bill his sketch, and they were amazed at how closely the two figures resembled one another that they had drawn. And they do resemble each other very, very closely, which means either they got together and decided what to draw, or they both saw the same anomalous, weird little creature.
Anomaly came up again.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, so the third sighting is Will Tainter and Abby Brabham. This was approximately 24 hours after John Baxter's sighting, so April 22nd. A trainer is driving Brabham home, and I don't know, did I mention Baxter's age? I guess I didn't. I think he was 15. Trainer was 18, Brabham was 15. Baxter may have been younger than that, actually. He may have been 13. I'd have to double-check that, because he was the youngest of all of them. So anyway, they're driving about a quarter of a mile out of Dover on Springdale Avenue. Brabham, Abby Brabham, saw something in the headlights in the left lane. It was atop a culvert crossing a brook 1.2 miles east-northeast of John Baxter's sighting and 2 miles northeast of Bartlett's. A figure crouched on all fours was facing the car, matched the Dover Demon's description exactly, except for the color of the eyes. Abby was insistent over and over again through questioning that the eye color or reflection was green. And, of course, Bartlett said orange. The car was traveling at 40 miles an hour. Trainer only had a few second glimpse, and he never claimed to have the level of detail that Abby did. The team estimated that they had to have been no more than 8 feet away if they passed by the creature while it was still on the road. Size comparisons, Will Trainer said it was about the size of a goat. Abby Brabham said it was the size of a German Shepherd.
How big is
your friend and mine?
How big is a baby moose?
Oh, well, yeah, that's... about the same size, I would imagine. Yes, in a moment. So anyway, the longest look at this in this sighting would have been about 5 seconds. And Trainer's was less. The parents believed them, or at least said they were bothered and shaken up enough and that they weren't usually concocting stories and things like that. So... part of Webb's investigation was to ask adults that knew these kids fairly well about their character. And so Webb says he was overwhelmingly, that Bartlett was overwhelmingly endorsed by the people that he talked to. He had a science teacher named Robert Linton who accepted the story. However, there is one person, an anonymous teacher, that said Bartlett was quote-unquote troubled, that he cut classes, that he smoked with John Baxter, and he is quoted, this anonymous source is quoted as saying, if I had to pick out someone to pull something like this, it would be Bartlett.
When did Lauren get involved then?
Lauren was involved with all of this.
Yeah, like when does he come, when does he first come into the story, do you know?
Yeah, well, I told you.
Did you?
Yeah, he was involved a week after it happened.
A week and a half after. I remember that now.
Yeah, yeah. He was involved. He interviewed all of the principal witnesses by himself to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Then came back and interviewed them with the team that was assembled by Webb.
Is Mysterious America the first time he writes about this then?
I'm pretty sure, yes. Okay. Yeah. And at least in the most recent edition, he places Webb's full report first, and then he gives his own comments about it. But I'm not sure how it was in the original edition, if he just wrote about it or if he reproduced Webb's report in that as well.
How quickly do people start insisting this is a baby elk or moose?
That's not until like decades later. And it's the work of basically one guy.
Who?
He's a Minnesota-based farmer and UFO guy.
Okay. Can we talk about that real quick? Because I'm very curious about that. What does Lauren have to say about the moose hypothesis?
Well, he spends about 4 or 5 pages in the e-reader edition saying why it can't be a baby moose. A lot of them having to do with it being the wrong time of year for baby mooses to be spotted. Mm-hmm. That it's the wrong size, that by the time a baby moose is agile enough to go places, it's much larger than what the Dover Demon would have been. And there's not that many nuisance moose in the Boston area to begin with.
Do moose have eye shine too? Because this thing had glowing...
I would imagine. I mean, most animals do.
It was seen glowing yellow.
Orange in the case of Bartlett and then green. And they were very firm on that as far as what they saw.
Deer also have green eye shine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What so, I mean, Lauren was involved in this to the degree that, he got this anonymous sort of character bashing of Bartlett, and he went back to the anonymous source personally to double check. Are you really saying what I think you're saying? And he never budged, but that teacher was the only one
to object to Bartlett's character. Where does Lauren stand on this then these days?
He thought that Bartlett was the most credible witness, and Abby Brabham would be second place. He feels Tainter was a good corroborating witness, but Tainter never claimed to have a full-fledged, detailed sighting. And he said Baxter's was the least credible only because he was the youngest, and these kids were questioned again and again. And he felt like Baxter started to ramp up details or insistence on what he had seen, not making things up, but he sensed that he wasn't being taken seriously, so he kind of, I don't know, pushed a little too hard. But Lauren didn't think, and as of the writing of the 2000 edition of Mysterious America, he was convinced that these kids were telling the truth and that they weren't making up a hoax.
So the most common, people draw a line between this creature and like an alien gray because of like the big eyes and the, mm-hmm. way the head shaped and all that. Lauren refutes that, right? Like he hates, I don't think he wants anything to do with that because he's always talking about the fact that there were no UFO sightings around that general time. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Well,
by the way, for listeners, Mark's the only one who did any research on this episode.
I watched a lost tape.
That's right. Well, first let me say this. Here's just a short list of potential explanations that have been given for the Dover Demon. A wet dog, a newborn horse, a school prank, a homeless person, an escaped monkey,
and logical.
Yeah. An escaped laboratory animal, a sick fox. And then you get into things like, of course, extraterrestrial visitors, a ghost, fairies, little folk.
Oh, yes. All right. So we're going there. Fairies.
Yeah. Puckwudgies. Yeah. Right. I mean, ultimately, that suggests itself. I mean, it's not like any puckwudgie that has ever been reported before.
It's a new species of puckwudgie.
Yeah. But its proximity to the Bridgewater Triangle and sort of its very limited sighting, and it didn't even seem to be doing anything. And that's the one thing, I guess, that would differentiate it from a Pukwudgie story.
There's no trickster element.
No, there's not. There really isn't. If anything, there's just sort of a blank stare, an acknowledgement almost that it's seeing you. I mean, but that's as far as it goes.
The baby horse thing doesn't hold a lot of water for me. The baby moose thing might, because I've driven through that area. I mean, there's signs on the roads to watch out for moose or elk. What's the difference? Do I want to say this?
Yeah, are bigger.
Do I want to say this right now?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, moose are much bigger.
Okay, baby moose. Well, either way, okay. But the UFO thing, there weren't any reports going on around that time, right? Isn't that what we always come back to?
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yeah, the UFOs, and the thing is, if there were, these are the people who would have known.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, meaning the team, because these are MUFON. These are like their own self-contained UFO study groups.
Did the Dover Demon try to probe anyone that we know of?
Maybe a baby moose.
Okay.
I don't know.
that's appropriate, Mark.
That's a leading question.
Yeah.
So I think now here's something to think about as well. None of these kids made an effort to publicize their claims. You know, all of this came about because somebody happened to mention this to Lauren Coleman, and he made the effort to reach out and talk to these kids. So unless, you know, they thought that they could somehow randomly get in contact with Lauren Coleman and feed him this story, there was no effort that these kids put forward. You know, at a week plus time had passed, and they weren't calling the news. They weren't calling the TV. This was, at first, an individual investigator coming to them, and then the story got out, but they weren't pushing it out.
Well, it's also interesting that we've got this and the Flatwoods Monster case as these, like, one-offs. In Ohio, we've got the Charles Mill Lake Monster, which is a similar thing. Like, you've got one or two sightings that happen, and that's it, and that never goes anywhere. Like, what? I mean, what says the Jersey Devil that we just talked about in the last episode apart from something like Flatwoods or the Dover Demon, where it happens and then it never, I mean, if it's all a hoax, you know, which I'm not saying it is, but I'm saying if that is your line of thinking that all this stuff's a hoax, why do some stories pass into, well, no, it's not even passing into folklore. It's like they become this ongoing, well, like what propels one monster over the next into that realm of popularity?
Yeah, that's a great...
people want to add themselves to the history.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, in the case of the Dover Demon, that story had traction somehow to the point where, you know, there's been vinyl figures of the Dover Demon made.
There's an episode of Lost Tapes.
Yeah,
Lost
Tapes. That's when you know you've made it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's pretty fascinating. And I think the thing that, having reviewed the case for the podcast, I mean, what I was reminded of is that all the principal witnesses were teenagers. And I just found something very, very intriguing about, you know, that these teenagers were being taken seriously enough by a group of fairly critical thinking adults that this is, you know, the end result is here we are talking about it. And it's in, you know, almost always when you talk about cryptozoology, the Dover Demon is named. And just the seriousness with which they were taken, I think a lot of that speaks to Lauren Coleman and his work with young people. You know, that's always been an area of his I think he's passionate about. And I think, if anything, he would have pushed for them to be taken seriously, which is pretty interesting. It's unlike other stories, except you brought up Braxton County. I mean, there was an adult involved in the sighting, but mm-hmm. it was mostly young kids. People as well.
Yeah. Final thoughts?
I think the Dover Demon is definitely unique, even though we treat it as just any other cryptid. I think a lot of people don't realize the short time span and the small amount of witnesses. It just gets thrown in there, and I think you really should, if you have the opportunity, take a moment and just look into it a little bit more, whether it's Mysterious America or something else.
I thought he was going to say Lost Tapes.
No.
Final thoughts, Mark.
Okay. It's interesting and I think important that all of the adults, save for one, the anonymous teacher at the school, believe that the kids saw something. That was their conclusion. As of 2000, Lauren Coleman accepted the reality of Bartlett's sighting as an actual unknown encounter. He goes on record in A Mysterious America and uses that phrase. He wrote about Baxter that Baxter seemed sincere, but not as convincing as the other witnesses. Abby Bramham came across very well to the investigators. She would not change the details, even the eye color. She was insistent. What she had seen is what she had seen. Tainter was a good, quote-unquote, confirming witness. Lauren Coleman does address the weed issue and says that, hallucinations are not generally associated with marijuana. And I thought this was really, there's a lot to think about in this next statement. He says, these witnesses, teenage witnesses, were interviewed nonstop during an intensive four-week period. They began to think that they should, quote-unquote, know why these sightings happened and often felt forced to answer questions as if they had all the answers. And so he kind of bottom lines it by saying, the Dover Demon is a true enigma. You have four credible young people who saw something for which there's no explanation.
If you like the show, you can leave us a rating and review on iTunes or Podbean. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Not Instagram yet.
It's hidden.
It's hidden. It's somewhere on Instagram. You can listen on all your favorite podcatchers except Google, which I need to submit us to. Maybe by the time you're listening to this. I hope you had a happy Thanksgiving. Or are having a happy Thanksgiving when you listen to this episode, which was recorded very early in November. Check us out next week. Thanks for listening.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com. It is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.